So, yes, I'm going to, as I say, the title of my talk is something like 43 years in Tri Ratna Buddhist community. Of course, the Tri Ratna Buddhist community wasn't called that back in 1976 when I first came along. It was called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. And I have a feeling in this talk I'm likely to go between the two, sometimes say Tri Ratna, sometimes say FWBO, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. In a way, I'm just going to, some will be slightly autobiographical, my own first connections with the FWBO, and then some will be a few reflections on how things have changed over the last 40 years or so, as I see it, purely through the lens, really, of my own experience, my own eyes. So, yes, I came in contact in 1976. Quite a few of you definitely were alive at that time. You know, what was happening in the world, certainly in the Western world, even in the United Kingdom at that time? Well, today, you just Google the answer, and I did. In Google, it reminded me that actually it was the previous year the UK had a referendum in when 67% of the general public were in favour of staying in the European Union. So I thought that was a really interesting bit, which I don't remember. But anyway, that was the case. But obviously, back in 1976, there was no Google. There were no mobile phones, personal computers. There was no internet. We live in a very, very different world. What I do remember of 1976 was it was the hottest summer on record, and I suspect anyone who lived through that will remember that. I was 25 years old in 1976. I was living in Cornwall, lucky me, and I was training to be a midwife. I had recently returned from an overland trip that had taken me from London to Kathmandu in a converted gasboard van. That was not uncommon in those times, those overland trips. I had just come back from there, and I suppose it was when I was there and with some of the people I travelled and some of the travellers I met on that journey, I met people who meditated. And when I arrived back in England, went down to Cornwall, it was meditation that I was interested in doing. I wanted to learn meditation. So here I am as a 25-year-old. I'm in this hospital in Truro. And on the hospital notice board, there were two posters. One was for Transcendental Meditation, TM, as it was called. So these were classes running in Transcendental Meditation. You had to pay £20 to get a mantra and commit yourself to chanting that every day. That sounded both weird and expensive. The other one was for Buddhist meditation. It was free. There was no commitment. Fine to just drop in. That appealed. I did. And that class was going to be held at a place called the People's Palace in Truro. The hospital I was in was just a little bit outside of Truro. And I had a bicycle, I also had an old car, but I had a bicycle, and I went down to Truro to try and find these classes that were being held. And you know how your imagination works, the People's Palace. So I had, my imagination was this exotic place. I mean, I had been in India, and I'd ended up a little bit on a Hare Krishna ashram and things. So I imagined all this sort of exotic abode and people dressed colourfully and things. And there was this rather half-boarded-up building, the People's Palace. Everything was closed. Didn't look as though any classes were going on. I went down three times. At my third time, when I was about to give up, there was a very friendly woman who said, "Oh, yes, come on. Yes, we're leading a meditation class on the top floor." That woman was, her name was Janet then. She's now Ratna Vandana, who some of you will know. So I went into this condemned wreck of a building and had to sign a disclaimer acknowledging that I was going in at my own risk. And little did I know what that meant. That was my introduction both to meditation and to Buddhism and to the FWBO. The FWBO had only been founded 9 years before and the order established 8 years before. So yes, Janet, who was a Mitra, was leading these meditation classes, and maybe half a dozen people came along to them. And I remember in this top room, in this wreck of a building, actually the room was quite nice, there was a little coffee table, and she would open up this box and she'd put a nice cloth over the table and she'd bring a posy of wild flowers. She lived in a caravan out in the countryside. And then this Buddha image, which I wasn't too sure about, and candles and incense. I loved all that. And she taught 1 week mindfulness of breathing, next week metta bhavana. And then we had a tea break. Ratna Ghosha was just saying, tea breaks are sort of part of an FWBO Tree Ratna institution. Actually, I remember another friend's sister who was a Buddhist in a different tradition saying, the thing about the FWBO, you spend all your time having tea breaks. But there was something positive about tea breaks. So we had a tea break, which in those days I seem to remember drinking an awful lot of barley cup, herb teas and instant coffee. Instant coffee was a bit of a thing. But also, Janet would have this box with books, Buddhist books inside, and each time she'd open up this box and, a few of these books would come out. And I remember looking at them. One was a survey of Buddhism, one was the Three Jewels, both books by Bhante, Sangharakshita. And, I flicked through them and I closed and put them back. They just seemed extremely dense. But actually, I loved that there was a ritual about. Actually, Ratna Vandana is a very ritualistic person, but she opened up this box and it always smelt of incense, and I used to love that. There was something a bit sort of exciting and exotic about that. After a few weeks, she said, today we're going to start, after the tea break, listening to some taped lectures of Sangharakshita. Now, I had no idea who Sangharakshita was. So as I was concerned, this was just a few people coming together who were Buddhists or had an interest in Buddhism, and that they'd found these lectures by this man whose name was impossible to pronounce, called Sangharakshita, who then I heard that he was also called Bhante, and that was much easier to say. If you like, she said to me, you can stay on and listen to these lectures on Buddhism. As I say, it was meditation that had drawn me in, but actually it was Buddhism that sort of things began to click with me. If it had just been those two meditation practices, and that's all we'd learned, after a few weeks I'd have drifted off, I'm pretty sure. So we started listening to Bhante's taped lectures on the Noble Eightfold Path, starting right at the beginning with Right Vision. We listened to them. They were played on a cassette tape on a small, tinny, portable cassette machine. And I was captivated. As I say, I had no idea who this man was, but just those opening lectures were absolutely brilliant. And I just remember sitting there and being stunned and thought, wow, so much of this resonated with what I'd been thinking for myself. And it went so much further than anything I had possibly sort of conceived of or really understood about life and the human predicament. Then we go down the pub. And that was always a part of our group down in Cornwall. Meditation, tea break, tape lecture, down the pub. And actually going down the pub was great. It was a way to really mix a bit more with those other people. And they were a very friendly lot of people and I felt very, very welcomed. So it was, as I say, Buddhism as much as meditation that really drew me in. And it was Buddhism as articulated by Bhante through the taped lecture series. That was very much my door to understanding the Dharma. I never had any inclination to shop around with other Buddhist groups. I have to say, there weren't many. There were a few Tibetans or a few Zen Buddhists down in Cornwall as well. And I did go to one Tibetan puja, which lasted 3 hours, and I thought, I have no idea what's going on. And I never again would have stuck around if that had been my main introduction to Buddhism. Then I went on my first retreat. See, some of this, it'll be the same and different, because a lot of you will have come along, you know, to a centre, to a small group, and then you go on a retreat. So, you know, some things haven't changed so much. And the person who led this retreat had another impossible to pronounce name, Manju Vajra, and his name had been on that original poster. By this time, that poster, by the way, was completely outdated. That's why the meditation classes weren't happening when I first went along to them. He had actually formed this small Buddhist group in Cornwall, but by this time he was living in London. But anyway, he'd come down every 6 weeks or so to Cornwall to lead weekend retreats. And he wasn't at all what I expected. You know, a Buddhist, and the people kept saying, this order member, yes, order member's coming, order member, yeah, I didn't know what an order member was. You know, I imagined maybe he would be in robes, maybe he'd be sort of shaven-headed and sort of wear robes, perhaps. And here was this guy who was really not much older than me, long hair, droopy moustache, stripy sweater. He was dead cool. I thought, yeah, I was young. a bit of a hippie, really, he looked. And, you know, he was the one who led this first weekend retreat. I have to say, Buddhism and meditation weren't household words in those days. I'm not sure that I had ever seen a Buddha image before that little one that Janet put on the shrine, except for I was familiar with the laughing Buddha, the fat Buddha. So when people talk about sort of the Buddha, that's what I was thinking of. And I thought, well, why are they worshipping that fat laughing Buddha? Anyway, this retreat was held in a small cottage, and there were maybe about six or eight of us. It was freezing cold in the middle of winter. We did triple meditations before breakfast. Now, this is where some of Tree Ratna has changed. Everybody got up for it. Actually, it was so cold, you almost had to. We did triple meditations before breakfast, and that was interspersed with walking and chanting. So you do mindfulness of breathing, walking and chanting, sit down. Metta Bhavana, walking and chanting, sit down, just sitting for 20 minutes at the end. Then you get up, then you have breakfast. We had work periods. It was chopping wood because there was a fire in the cottage. We'd do more meditation. We'd listen to Bhante on tape. And that's a common theme back in those days. Really, all our learning came from Bhante, and we listened to tape lectures of his. So it would always be a group of people sitting around listening to Bhante articulating the Dharma. Sometimes they were sort of single lectures, sometimes they were a series, and you'd hear several, week in, week out. But on that particular retreat, I remember Manju Vajra was playing on our behalf some lectures from the Sutra of Golden Light. And on that retreat, there were a whole lot of what were then called the newsletter, the FWBO newsletters, and those were sort of hanging around on the table. And I flicked through those, and it was then that I realised, oh my goodness, this is a whole movement of people, of young men and women, practising the Dharma, doing all these rather exciting things, going off on retreats together, working together, building things, knocking down things. It felt very, very exciting. Meanwhile, we were sitting down there, sitting on saggy sofas around a nice cosy fire. We did communication exercises, which I think are still done today, are they? I don't know. And we had evening pujas. It took me quite a while to get used to pujas, but I was also extremely attracted to them. But I think there was a whole thing about worship and bowing to a Buddha. But anyway, I was compelled. Others came down to Cornwall at different times from London to our little group. I mean, really, I think London was probably our nearest centre, 350 miles away or whatever. But they'd come down from London and join in our retreat. So actually, I got a lot of attention from order members coming down. I think Sangha Devi came down once. And those retreats, you know, would have the same format, metta, mindfulness, just sitting, Sometimes we do the stupa visualization practice. That was done quite a lot, I seem to remember, in my early days. Mantra chanting, listening to lectures, discussions, sevenfold pujas. Retreats at that time, don't particularly remember in Cornwall, but other ones later, nearly always had yoga as part of the retreat program, and practically everybody did it. There were quite a few Buddhist order members and mitras who'd been out and studied with Mr. Iyengar in Pune in India and had come back, and Iyengar yoga was taught on practically every retreat that we went on, which was great. So at some point I went up country, as they say, from Cornwall on my first bigger retreat. So the FWBO, you know, we were still pretty small. So that although little places all around the country no doubt were holding smaller retreats, we had a big summer annual retreat and often, I think, a Christmas one as well. And I went on my big summer retreat probably a year and a half or so after my first contact. We didn't have retreat centres there. Padmaloka was got, but otherwise we didn't really have retreat centres. But we did have, used to hire schools. So my first retreat was in a school in Gloucestershire. Men, and we were a lot more men than women. The order members on that retreat were all men. There were no women order members. They were actually off doing, creating their own community in a part of London. And again, those lectures of Bhante's on that particular retreat, night after night, we'd sit listening to these lectures and you could hear a pin drop, all listening to the Dharma together. And, you know, I found Bhante so clear in his Dharma teaching. He was clear and he was poetic. He was lofty and sublime, or what he was teaching was lofty and sublime, but also incredibly pragmatic, very down to earth at the same time. So this whole mix just, I found, transported us. It was quite magic for me at that point. And I had, and I'm sure other people had, quite a lot of beginner's mind experiences. And it's very soon that I felt I really want to throw in my lot with this FWBO, with these people, with this teacher. There were very, very few books available, Buddhist books available at that time. As I say, there was the Survey and the Three Jewels, but they were pretty dense for a beginner. So most of my understanding was through listening to lectures. Later, obviously, order members were giving lectures. And those lectures, as I say, they were on cassettes, and they were called Dharma Chakra tapes. So all Bhante's lectures that he gave in public places or at Buddhist centres, they were all recorded, mostly, I think, on reel-to-reel tapes, and then later they were made into cassettes. So then you could buy cassettes. And a lot of us would actually collect these cassettes. And, you know, when a new series was coming out, you'd collect your cassettes and have your own sort of volume there, and you'd lend them out to other people. Dharma Chakra tapes, which was set up by an order member called Ananda, that was what you could say now has become Free Buddhist Audio, where there's hundreds and thousands of lectures that you can listen to, not just by Bhante, but by order members all over. So that was very much the basis of my training and understanding of the Dharma. Some of those lectures were transcribed into a magazine which was called Mitratar, which would come out, I think, about three times a year. Within those Mitratars, there might be a lecture or sections of a lecture. And also, Bhante would sometimes do seminars on aspects of those lectures. So there'd be question and answers and other things also going into those Mitratars. And you'd get to understand a lot of the current themes that are around at that time, sort of current themes, because there's what Bhante was producing, but there's also people's interaction with that. Well, how do we bring this Dharma that you're teaching into our life in very practical ways? going back to Cornwall, so a group of us down in Cornwall decided we'd set up a community. I wasn't even a Mitra then. It was mixed genders, men and women, or boys and girls almost, we were. We were probably, I think we were all under 30, which in the light of what was happening elsewhere in the FWBO, where there was a strong segregation of the sexes, it wasn't particularly a dumb thing to set up a mixed community. But that's what we did. We were only a few of us, and we did that. So single sex was quite a beginning to become quite a theme and a big influence at that time in the late 70s in the FWBO. It was so against the mood of the times. You know, I'd lived through the sexual revolution. Well, I hadn't really lived it, but, you know, I'd been through it. And in a way, I was quite sort of interested in it. And suddenly, and also I'd been to an all-girls boarding school. And suddenly, you know, and then I'd lived in mixed households and things. I really enjoyed that. And then suddenly all this single-sex influence was coming in. I thought, oh, you know, it felt to me a bit retrogressive, is that the word? Yeah, something like that. However, you know, it was happening. And I think, you know, one has to remember that in part the single-sex activities were set up because of tensions that arose between the sexes, which could be a distraction to the spiritual life. And, you know, clearly that was going on and it did happen. We were all very young. I'm going to keep making this point because, you know, I look around the audience now and, you know, there's a huge range of people, but we were all in our 20s and maybe just early 30s by then. It did take me quite a while to understand and really get the benefits of single sex. But, you know, Banti was obviously very much encouraging us to be individual, and perhaps women needed to spend more time with women and men needed to spend more time with men. And I think, you know, a lot of good has come out of that. And also I think there was a lot of confusion because things got quite dogmatised. You know, we were a bit zealous at times. But, you know, ultimately, Banti was wanting us to be really, really more and more individual. And I think there's certain things when you're sort of exploring individuality that perhaps you can do more easily, more readily with people of your own gender. Meanwhile, you know, here was I still down in Cornwall, but meanwhile, in London and Brighton and Norwich and Glasgow, all sorts of residential communities were being set up that were tended to be single sex. As I say, those attracted to Buddhism and the FWBO were young men and women, and those who were attracted to living in those communities on the whole were young. And many definitely were benefiting very greatly from them, developing friendships with others, holding shared values and enthusiasms. Okay, coming back to me in Cornwall, I was encouraged by Manju Vajra to go on a women's retreat. As I said, I really couldn't see the point, and I went on this retreat, and I'm not going to say anything about that here, but if you buy my memoir, you can read about it. I hated it. I was just talking to somebody in the tea break who didn't enjoy one of her retreats, but that was probably for different reasons. But anyway, I really, really did not enjoy this retreat. And at the end of it, I even thought, I don't know whether I want to stick around the FWBO. You can read more in the memoir. however, and this I think is rather typical of the times, me as well probably, but also the times, within 3 months I had moved from Cornwall to Norfolk to live in the first women's community and retreat centre. So you can see it wasn't all bad. I had my reactions, I had my own conditioning and stuff. But what attracted me to that was I developed a really good friendship with an order member, Marlene. And she was the first woman, I think, who I really felt a connection with. And, you know, I began to really understand actually how I could share myself so well and so easily with another woman. And she was great. She was such a friend to me. And we clicked. And I suppose I had my first real taste of Kalyana Mitrata at that time. I made other good friends, and over subsequent years, I definitely came to totally appreciate single-sex activities. I think the strongest benefits of those single-gender activities has survived up till today, and I hope we never lose them completely. you know, I know they can be debated and things, but I think there's so much that's so good about them. So a little bit about Bhante. I first met him one-to-one after that rather disastrous for me retreat. I met him, he was living at Padmaloka at that time, which is a men's retreat centre up in Norfolk. He was warm, he was friendly, he was interested in me and what I was doing. And he was very much asking me about Cornwall and our group down there. I had seen him once before. I'd seen him on that other upcountry retreat that I'd been on when he came down to do an ordination of a Finnish man. And at that point, he was wearing robes. It was hot summer's day. He was wearing robes and this thick pullover underneath. I couldn't really work him out at all. He was over there somewhere. This time, when I met him one-to-one, he was incredibly, you know, very easy to... He was very approachable. I felt very easy to be able to sort of just talk with him. It's just like talking with him. I didn't have any profound questions. He was so relaxed, and he was sitting there in his carpet slippers and a cardigan. It was either a jumper or a cardigan with a bit of holes in the elbows. And I suppose the main thing was at that moment in time when I was really wondering, do I want to stick around, was I felt heard, seen, and I was really, really encouraged. Now, a bit more about Bhante. Back in the 70s and 80s, everyone who was serious about their Dharma practice met Bhante personally. They met Bhante personally. He was our teacher. He was our founder. He was our guide. He was the only one who had years of Buddhist practice under his belt, if you see what I mean. The rest of us, we were all just kind of new to it. You did have the occasional person who came along who perhaps practiced Buddhism a bit, but on the whole, it was Bhante who was way up there, and it was all of us. So we all had, even if you didn't have a strong personal connection with him, you did feel that connection very deeply, very strongly. And a very respectful relationship. Bhante was and continued to be a man of great discipline. He had disciplined habits, I put here. I'm not sure that's grammatically correct, but anyway. He would tend to work all mornings, writing books, preparing lectures, studying texts, reading a wide range of literature, answering letters. After lunch, he'd have a walk, often with a friend. Then he'd see people individually. That was primarily his routine. Of course, he had trips out and about with friends too. And a bit later, when he was living above the LBC, he would go out anonymously and alone into central London to browse around the second-hand bookshops. And of course, he had times of more focused meditation. I've been very fortunate in the last month or so hearing Paramartha. Paramartha is a very, very close friend of Bhante's over many, many years. And, has been very devoted to Bhante and had a very harmonious and clear friendship. And I've been hearing quite a bit about Paramartha's been talking about some of their times together and how, you know, they'd be meditating and Bhante would actually wake Paramartha up to get up to do a, you know, 6 o'clock meditation, and how they'd meditate together in the early mornings, and then over breakfast they'd share their dream life together. You know, there aren't many of us who have that kind of connection with Bhante, but, you know, Bhante no doubt sort of needed that and needed that with various people. Every so often, Bhante would hold a seminar on a particular Buddhist text, which might go on for a week or more, with small groups of mitras and order members. And I was ordained on one such seminar. This was held at Padmaloka. The men moved out of Padmaloka, thank you, and the women moved in. And Bhante probably said that Bhante could continue some of his routines, but also it was probably a bit more comfortable place than anywhere else. And we studied every day with Bhante. Were you there? The Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Gampopa's text. And we'd sit around, I think quite a lot of us were sitting around on the floor. He'd be sitting there in his wingback chair. And at the end of that seminar, I was ordained. That was 1980. I'm going a bit in and out of time here, but I think what I'm trying to get over is a bit of the flavour of the times and Bhante and our personal kind of connection with him. So I was living by this time at this women's retreat centre, which was called Mandarava, and we'd invited him over for lunch. And I went over to collect him from Padmaloka, and I had an old car, an old Morris Traveller. They were those sort of box shapes, you know, Morris Miners, with the bit on the back. So the one with the wooden bits and the wooden doors that open up the back is rather cool. Anyway, I drove into Padmaloka, in front of Padmaloka, and Kulananda, who was living there then, was rather aghast when he saw this old banger, because it really was a bit old banger. However, Bhante seemed completely at his ease and, you know, got into the car and was quite happy to be driven over to Mandarava. And after all, we hadn't got much of an alternative. The only other person living at Mandarava who had a car was Beryl, who later became Ratnasuri, which was a three-wheeler Robin Reliant. And one of the reasons you had a three-wheeler was you didn't have to take a test. And Beryl wasn't the best driver, so I think it was better that he had my Morris Traveller, and I had spruced it up a bit. Yes, I'll say a bit more about Beryl actually in a moment, but you know, I keep going back to this thing that the great majority of us were young and in our 20s, but also most of us were from fairly middle-class backgrounds, were reasonably educated. And we lived in times when dropping out from mainstream society was not unusual. But then, what do you drop into? You know, hippiedom in a way was quite attractive. I always sort of slightly aspired to be a hippie. I never quite made it, I don't think. But it really wasn't going anywhere. Buddhism and the FWBO offered a whole range of ideals, teachings, practices and inspiration which felt revolutionary and struck a deep chord with many of us. Many, like me, were happy and ready to throw in our lot with the vision of a new society. We had a whole life ahead of us to live. Now, Beryl Ratnasuri, on the other hand, she was quite different and she was quite unique. She was about 30 years older than most of us. She had lived through the war. She'd worked in a chocolate factory. She had a family. She's just had her 96th birthday this week. She was primarily very much on her own at the time as an older woman. How different from today. Yeah. So although maybe not so many 96-year-olds, you know, we've got this whole wide spread of people now. Anyway, at the end of 1978, I moved to the London Buddhist Centre and was there for the initial opening events, which were brilliant, which were held in the old burnt-out fire station of Bethnal Green, which is now the London Buddhist Centre. Now, according to FWBO mythology, Subhuti said it would take 1 year and cost £10,000 to build the London Buddhist Centre. It took 5 years and cost £100,000. That's a bit the way we were, certainly the way Subhuti was at the time. Optimistic. All the work that was done on that building, which was, you know, another wreck, was done by Buddhists. All the funding was raised by Buddhists. I think something to get across, you know, as I was thinking about what I might say in this talk, something I feel I really need to get across is we had no big benefactors, sadly. We weren't like Rajneesh, you know, who seemed to attract really rich people. We never did. Back in those days, we never attracted people with much money. We raised most of the money ourselves, starting with jumble sales, and later livelihood businesses, Buddhists working together. Of course, some people were very generous as well and gave money, bigger sums of money. Bhante has never lived in any kind of luxury. Quite recently in his little flat at Adistana, you know, I've been to look around it, and it really was a tiny space that he was living in, you know, with a little conservatory, a little sitting room where he'd meet people, a small dining room, a tiny bedroom. You know, that was where his world was. So he's never lived in great luxury. Ratnagosha doesn't have a fleet of Rolls Royces, do you? No. The great majority of us lived on minimal support, and I was totally happy to do this. Like many others, I lived in a community. I lived down in a community down the road from the London Buddhist Centre. I worked in various of the businesses that were beginning to grow up around the London Buddhist Centre. I worked in an illegal cafe, you could say, come soup kitchen, which was behind whitewashed windows. We had to be behind whitewashed windows because it wasn't legal. In a rather derelict building next door to the London Buddhist Centre. From the outside, there was no sign or anything. You wouldn't have known it was there. You had to be in the know. And, you know, it was feeding those who were working in the businesses around the London Buddhist Centre, but also a few other people, you know, who lived in the area began to get to know about it, and they were getting nice vegetarian meals. Those businesses initially all ran as cooperatives, and I'll just mention a few of the ones I could remember. There was a typesetting business. All these were Buddhists, mostly single-sex teams. A second-hand shop, a design studio, a printing press, a building and decorating business, a whole food shop, a hardware shop. A whole Buddhist village was growing up around the London Buddhist Centre, which was the main centre at that time in the UK. Years later, that really happened here in Cambridge. There were a lot of communities all around, actually just here, which was also a bit of a Buddhist village. The idea was that we would support ourselves on very basic support and give profits for the Buddhist Centre and the wider movement, offering all Buddhism and meditation classes for free. You know, everything was on dana basis. Some people around the London Buddhist set up a housing association, which meant short life properties, of which there were quite a lot at that time, properties that were likely to be maybe demolished or done up at a later date, could be used. And well, so these were well utilised for communities springing up in the area. The London Buddhist Centre eventually got a local authority grant for £5,000 to do up that cafe behind the whitewashed windows, and that for that building, and it opened in 1980 as the Cherry Orchard Vegetarian Restaurant, which again was run entirely by women Buddhists and carried on for about 30 years. It only closed. There is still a restaurant there, but it's not run by Buddhists anymore. I was the first manager of that restaurant. So all sorts of emphases were developing within the Sangha, which impacted on the way we lived and the way we gained our livelihood as Buddhists. The late 70s and I'd say 80s were a time of great experimentation within the FWBO, finding ways, you know, in collaborative ways, we could fully live the Dharma in our Western world. We were not traditional monks and nuns. We weren't traditional monk lay split. You know, Bhante had articulated all that so clearly. There was lots of trial, lots of error, lots of experimentation. When it came to the businesses, there were very few of us who were business minded. Almost nobody had a professional background. Many were ex-hippies, and we were very, very idealistic. There was, it has to be said, a lot more enthusiasm than expertise. We were very, very inspired by Bhante's vision of a new society, a world based around Buddhist values, and we wanted to spread that vision as far as possible and as fast as possible. And that was the great thrust in that time, I think, within the order and movement. So I was around the... I'm focusing sort of quite a lot on this short period of time because I think it was a very time when sort of so much was fermenting and going on. So I was around the London Buddhist Centre, 78 to 82, and my experience was a time of great energy and enthusiasm, and we really did believe we could change the world. And this whole thing of spreading out the Dharma. And we didn't just want to be UK-centric. In those 4 years that I lived around the LBC, I witnessed people going off far and wide. People went off to the USA, Manjivadra and Vajradhaka, to set up Buddhist activities, Buddhist centres. Others went off to Australia. Lokamitra and Padmavajra went off to India. Others went off to Germany. And, you know, it was always a huge thing when these people went off. I remember when Manjivadra and Vajradhaka went off and we said goodbye to them from the London Buddhist Centre. And, you know, remember, there was no internet, no emails, no nothing. You know, they were going off and it just felt this heroic thing to go and set up the FWBO in America, of all places. Yes, when would we see them again? How would we keep in touch? Also, new centres were setting up in the UK in many towns and cities. A dedicated meditation retreat centre was set up at Vajraloka. That was new. Not long after, sometime in the 80s, Taraloka was founded, primarily by Sangadevi and others. A retreat centre and community solely for women. The money was raised primarily by women. Most of the conversion work of Taraloka was done by women. The whole vision of Taraloka was radical in itself, and it was completely novel, I think, in the Buddhist world at large. It's easy now to take a lot of these things for granted. You know, we just, oh, off to Taraloka. Yeah, there's an awful lot. And, you know, I'm just picking out one thing, particularly because Sangadevi's here, but it's also been such an instrumental place for women. So there was a lot of optimism. We were quite naive. Things got messy. Most were single. Most people who came along were single at that time. Most lived together in communities and many worked together. And, you know, this wasn't just around the LBC. This was also in Manchester, Brighton, Norwich and so on. And this was great for us who were involved in it. But there was an unfortunate downside. I think perhaps initially quite unintentionally, we did create an atmosphere that suggested you could only seriously practice the Dharma if you were a full-timer in this kind of way. Living together, working together, throwing in your lot, not having any sort of family responsibilities, job responsibilities or anything. So because of this slight atmosphere or this slight downside, well, it was a big downside, I think, but this atmosphere that you could only seriously practice a Dharma if you were a full-timer, people who were not in the position to throw themselves in that full-time way, either because of family or career, found it hard to find ways of connecting. And I think many people in that era, who could have benefited from Bhante's approach to the Dharma, perhaps were put off by the FWBO. We certainly appeared rather zealous, and I think we didn't just appear, we were. In addition to that, the emphasis on single sex, I feel, did create some problems. There was tension between the two wings, male and female. Even that language only came in at a certain point, you know, that we have two wings, men's wing, the women's wing. And I'll just give an example of something here. I mean, actually, Sangadevi would know more because it was a bit before my time. But the women had done a lot of the fundraising for Sukhavati, the big men's community that's above the London Buddhist Centre, which was initially envisioned as having, I believe, two floors, one for men and one for women. But later, in the project, it was decided, by the sound of it, not in much consultation, if any, with the women, that the community would be for men only, women not even allowed in to visit. That, understandably, caused quite a bit of upset on the part of the women, and probably perhaps on the part of some of the men too. Having said that, you know, things were clumsy. Having said that, there was an upside because actually out of that, the women created their own large and quite radical single-sex community in Wanstead, East London, further out of East London, Amaravati. That was closed to men. There was a lot of experimentation going on there too, women finding their strong voices and their individuality away from men. And I think there was a lot of positivity that came out of that. I think Sangadevi lived there for a while. Padmavasini, who many of you know, lived there, and she could certainly tell you a tale or two. I've heard some of them. I remember going as a Mitra, going on the occasional Mitra day there, and actually I loved hearing the women expressing how they practice the Dharma, giving talks and articulating how they practice. So, as I say, I was ordained in 1980, and in 1982, I then went off to India to work with the FWBO in India. I've got a background in nursing, and I was doing medical work alongside Dharma teaching. I'm not going to say anything about that in this. A bit of it's in my memoir. But, of course, that's a whole other strain of Tri Ratna, what was going on in India. These hundreds of thousands of former untouchable Buddhists who converted to Buddhism under their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar, but really who didn't know much about practicing the Dharma. And, that was a huge spreading out of the Dharma and the FWBO in India. The next big development of the FWBO, as I see it, came in the mid-80s when Banti began to pass on the responsibility of ordination. For the first 19 years or so, Banti ordained everybody, men and women. The first change happened in India when three senior disciples of Banti, one of them being Subhuti, travelled out to India to ordain some of the Indian men. And in 1987, Banti asked myself and Srimala and Beryl, now Ratnasuri, to ordain two women in India. This was a huge culture shift. And the fact that men were, from now on, were to ordain men and women were to ordain women was entirely in keeping with the FWBO approach. But it was also very radical in the Buddhist world to have women ordaining women. Banti was always so foresightful. So that was a big culture shift. As you know, in subsequent years, a whole system now has evolved where today there are dozens of men and women preceptors keeping alive the lineage of Tri Ratna begun by Banti. When I was ordained, there was no such thing as an ordination process. Study was a bit random, what you get. I knew Banti. Order members who knew me told Banti they thought my going for refuge was effective, and that seemed to be enough. I mean, I think Banti knew me reasonably well by that time. Things were much, much more organic in those days. And at that time, everybody knew everybody. My first order weekend, all the order members from all over the United Kingdom congregated in the reception room at the London Buddhist Centre, which is really quite small when you look at it now. And that was the whole order in the UK, and we could all sit there, and I knew everybody bar one person, men and women. in a way, it was easier in some ways then. Everyone knew everybody. But as the movement got bigger, we, of course, needed to be much more thorough and systematised and have a much more systematised approach than what was possible in the early days. A full account of the FWBO history of the past 43 years that I've been involved would have to allude to the controversies that engulfed the movement, and particularly from 2000 onward, mostly around Sangharakshita's sexual activity. I think Vajragupta has dealt with that pretty well as anybody could, really, in the Tri Ratna story. And I know here in Cambridge there's been all sorts of groups to discuss all that kind of thing. And this has had an effect on the movement, there's no doubt about it. It affected all of us in different ways. And I think to some degree it did hamper the growth of the movement, both probably by undermining the confidence of some of those already involved, and possibly putting off, well, I'm sure it did put off other people who might otherwise have come along. Suffice to say, I don't think that issue is ever going to entirely go away. So that is part of our legacy. More generally, as Tri Ratna community has got bigger, we've had to get more organised. Along the way, some things have been gained and some things, I feel, have been lost. Tri Ratna definitely has become a much more effective vehicle for communicating the Dharma. More and more people have gained a deeper experience of Dharma practice, and they are able to communicate that from their own experience. We have so much more to offer today. All our centres in beautiful buildings, running a whole gamut of events, beginners' courses, beginners' retreats, retreats geared to study or meditation or some dharmic theme, men's retreats, women's retreats, non-binary retreats. We even have mixed retreats. And there is much more of a generational span. We still have people coming in at their 20s, and we have people, you know, in their 70s and 80s. I do recall, but I keep going back to her, but I do recall Beryl Ratnashuri organising retreats at one point for the, I can't remember if it was the over 50s or the over 60s, because she was a bit fed up, one of the reasons, she was a bit fed up being on retreat always with people going on, women going on about their periods, problems with partners and whether or not to have babies. Today, you have rather different issues. Those issues can still be there. You know, I think young people's events are, you know, have had quite a lot of focus, and I think they need to have, so that you can explore, young people can explore together, practice together, share your lives together. Personally, I think this is vital for the future of Tri Ratna. I also think that there's a lot for younger people to learn from those of us who've been practicing for Buddhism for a very long time. Very recently, I was on a young women's retreat up at Tri Ratna Loka, a long weekend. Hannah was on that retreat. Some of you will know Hannah. And she said how important it was that they weren't just young women, but also they had the interface with me and Ratnadarini and some of the people at Tri Ratna Loka community were there. So I think it needs both. I think young women, you were there as well, weren't you? Young people need to do things together, and they also need the interface with those who've been practicing the Dharma a lot longer. So despite the positive generational span that we have today, and despite the fact that people with families and all sorts of careers and lifestyles hopefully feel much more able to engage fully with Tri Ratna, despite the fact that things are more professional, more organised, I also do feel we have lost a little bit of our anarchic spirit. I know I'm not alone in thinking this. That spirit was very present in those early years of my involvement. But you cannot really organise and systematise anarchy. And so to some extent, we have also lost a certain intimacy that came about from an order particularly where basically everyone knew everybody else. I know some can feel a little nostalgic about those times, even though I can tell you it wasn't all good. But the anarchy and the intimacy were always going to be incompatible with our desire to spread the Dharma far and wide. That is so much part of Tri Ratna's vision. It's not just for me and myself in my little centre. I have always worked in, I'm coming quite near the end, I've always worked in and taken on various responsibilities in various capacities within Tri Ratna since those early days, both in India and back here. Naturally, there have been ups and downs. I've had my own personal ups and downs, as well as the movement's ups and downs. I've had all sorts of things to work on regarding my own conditioning. A biggie for me was working on whether the choice of whether or not to have children. That's all in my memoir in quite a lot of detail. The life of calm versus or balance with the life of activity, getting it out of balance quite often. Those sort of things can be in conflict. I've been spiritually stretched, especially when I was asked to be a public preceptor and join the College of Public Preceptors. I have to say, I have never doubted the Dharma, ever. I think right since that very early first retreat, though I have had my struggles with Tri Ratna at times. Having said that, primarily I feel blessed to have had so many Buddhist friends, some friendships, some which span back 40 years. I feel enormously fortunate to have found a teacher and to have shared my life with so many others, been on so many retreats in many beautiful places, alone and with others, to have meditated and studied and had spiritual experiences and realizations alongside others. I still feel Tri Ratna, with all its faults and foibles, is a hugely worthwhile project for individuals and for the world at large. I personally feel the world needs values that Buddhism offers, perhaps more than ever before. And right now, up to the present moment, we are entering a new phase. Bhante only died in the autumn, October. Even though he'd handed on his major responsibilities many years before, he still remained, and always will be, our founder and teacher. And while he was still alive, he was still consulted at times on all sorts of issues right up till the end. The new phase, in addition, the generation that largely created what we have today, we're getting old. You know, I'm about to be 68 next week. You know, a lot of us are in our that sort of time. Maybe many of us want to retire from a particular kind of involvement. And when I say retire, I think that's a dodgy word because I don't think you ever retire from being a Buddhist and a practitioner, but from being involved in a particular kind of way. Some of us want to step back perhaps a bit. It's not for us, my generation, to shape the future, particularly as the world we operate in has changed so much. The world is truly on fire with greed, hatred, and ignorance, perhaps more ever than before. We live in extreme times of stress. To counter that, I believe we need a strong sense of purpose, a continuity of purpose, and a great deal of love to face the challenges of our very troubled world, and a working together in harmony with all our diversities in our Sangha. So this talk was entitled 43 Years in Tri Ratna. Well, I certainly won't be here in 43 years' time. I'd be 111. And though I've got good genes, I think 111's pushing it. But I am very optimistic that Tri Ratna will be. I certainly hope it will. Though I can't imagine with any certainty what it will look like in 43 years' time. I hope some of you, many of you, will stick around to witness it and be part of its creation. I hope we will continue to be a radical and active Sangha on our journey towards transcendental freedom and with a true Bodhisattva spirit.